Just so it's a little clear, so people just understood, we're skipping to the Kina for the Shoah now. We're going to be saying the Kina this year of the Baba Vareda, which is a little bit more concise, and the Lashon is a little clearer than the Kina that we usually have been saying in the past of Rosh Shoah. When I was younger and I was in yeshiva, so I had the chus of going with yeshiva on a trip to Poland before Pesach, and it was an incredibly eye-opening week for me. It was a week that I felt that I was able to connect a little bit closer to my grandparents and to some of the horrors that they had gone through. We went to many of the camps, went to many of the shtetlach, went to many of the shuls, the kvarim, etc., etc. It was an extremely inspirational, extremely emotional week. I took 7 or 8 rolls of film. You'll explain to your kids what that means. And I recorded many of my thoughts on a cassette tape, which you can also explain what that means. And when I got back to Eretz Yisrael, so I had supposed that year that my parents came to be with me in Eretz Yisrael for Pesach, and my grandparents came as well. It was the first and only, it was the first time that I had the supposed of being with them. It was actually my father's mother's first time ever being in Eretz Yisrael. And I immediately went to go develop the film because I was so excited to show it to my mother's parents, who were survivors, just what, you know, and were Polish. Just what I had seen and been through, and I spent a little extra money to get it developed right away, and I came and I went to my Zaidi and I said, Zaidi, here's the picture. This is what I saw. I saw it. And he looked at me. He looked at the pictures quickly. He looked at me. He's like, you know, with a sensitive tone, basically saying, it's nice that you went to go visit a museum, but this does not do any justice to the horrors, to the Ganem that we lived through. So as I, year after year, seems to have gotten to become somewhat of a responsibility to present the Shoah, I feel less and less able to do so, and that my perspective is only a small, small insight into what really they went through. So I decided this year to maybe, instead of giving my own perspective, just go straight to the source. And I picked a small piece of some of my Bubby's testimonial that she gave 20 or so years ago, 25 years ago, and transcribed it, and basically just changed a couple of things for language, and because it was an interview, took out the interviewer and just made it more streamlined. So I just figured I'd read straight, because through the eyes of a person who went through it, even that is not enough to explain the horrors that they went through, but it's a little bit of an insight. My Bubby was in many, many camps over the five and a half years that the war took place in Poland. For much of 1944, she was in Gliwice, which was a sub-camp of Auschwitz. It was a working camp. And this was, again, just to give perspective, this was after 5 years of going from place to place, camp to camp, being shepherded around with absolutely nobody that she knew, not a single person, no family member. For all she knew, her entire family was gone. Baruch Hashem, it wasn't, but for all she knew, it was. Not a friend, not a soul from her hometown. And this is how she lived somewhere between the ages of 12 and 20. I'm not quite sure exactly, but she was somewhere between those ages during these years. Again, imagine your own daughter at the young teenage years going through this and having to go up on her own. She was in Gliwice until the end of December 1944. And she describes that they had started to take apart the camp and move everyone out. She says, then we started to march. They closed this camp because the Germans They were afraid the Russians were coming in, so they evacuated the camp. We took only with us our army blankets, and we were wearing these old shoes, the wooden shoes. These wooden shoes were like a little bit of a wedge that you just stuck your foot into and slipped in like a horseshoe. And we took the blankets and we marched. We marched. It was cold in January. It was the beginning of January, 45. We walked on snow, freezing. We walked with supervision, with lots of supervision, meaning the guards. They counted us all the time, just so we wouldn't disappear, and they gave us very, very little food, except for the soup that they gave us at night. When we came to a small city, they took us into barracks, or to places where they kept warehouses, and we simply lay down on the floor. We just slept through over there. One by one, we're laying just like sardines, not to use too much space on the floor. They gave us hot soup and a slice of bread, and this was our entire nourishment for the day. The soup was like broth with little vegetables, enough that we could fish for a small piece of potato. We had no idea where we were going. It was unknown and untold. The next day in the morning, they counted us again, and again we started to march. Hundreds of people, hundreds of men and women. The men in the front, women in the behind. There were no children because the children couldn't work and therefore they weren't in the camps. And we marched like this for 10 days. We saw many people falling like flies. Many people, especially the men, they were falling. They were being beaten by the Germans because they were slowing down. They couldn't walk so fast because the roads were slippery. They were ice and they were walking on their wooden shoes. And so the Germans just beat them up and they just fell like flies, and we watched, and we had no choice but to just keep on walking ahead. We couldn't stop. We had to march otherwise. We were beaten in the back if you didn't march. And they beat us with batons and with hard sticks. And just to comment over here, what Rabbi Brick said earlier about having to try to feel for others, just think about when you're marching and someone in front of you who, whether you care about it or not, another Jew is falling and you can't do a thing about it. Besides the own pain you're going through, you can't help anybody else. You just have to keep on going. They were not in position to help, to be able to help others. At the end of the march, which not too many survived, they put us into trains, open trains like you transport cattle. We were sitting quite a few days in the trains with no food. We were praying for the snow. Why did they want the snow? So that we could open our mouth and the snow would come in to drink the water from the snow. We had no idea where we were. We were guarded very closely. We walked from one train to the other one. We tried to go through the trains. We saw, as we're walking, they were stepping on dead people. We saw what's going on. They were just laying there. They couldn't survive. They weren't strong enough. They couldn't cope with this terror. They were just dying and laying on the floor for days, and we saw it. And here she inserts, when she was a kid, she says, I could never hear about a dead person as a child. I couldn't take it. A friend of ours died, and I was still a child. I lived with this horror for days and nights. And here I was, there weren't any therapists back then, here I was visualizing in front of me, and she just had to keep on going. A young girl steps on dead bodies, sees terrors, and just keeps on going. But still, we are fighting for ourselves to live through. And the trains, they couldn't even track us anymore. They didn't stop counting us because so many people were dead. It wasn't worth it anymore. And they finally took us to Ravensbrück. Ravensbrück was a huge camp. It was in the middle of Germany. It was a transition camp. All the other evacuations of all the other camps, again, this was towards the end of the war, they went through Ravensbrück, and it was also a crematorium camp. They had the ovens there. It was horrible. If Gleiwitz wasn't enough, this was worse. They had tents, big tents. 100 girls could be in one tent. The beds started low and they were built 3 stories up. And all we had was a blanket for ourselves and we're lying on a hard wooden board. Those who were in the second row were lucky. Why were they lucky? Because people who were in the first row of these beds were lying in water, because water would seep into the barrack, to the tent, and they just sat there laying like this. We got in the morning a coffee. It wasn't real coffee, it was, she called it ersatz coffee, I don't know, some type of fake coffee, and a slice of bread. And that was our nourishment for the day. And we were all sitting there in blankets covered. And that's what they went through day for day. She was there in Ravensbrück for 6 weeks. Al Eila Nibalchia. This is what I cry for. Everyone here has something to cry for, and that's the Avodas Hayom. Halavayim can all cry for the Mikdash, as the Rav Shlita mentioned, for Jacob's mentioned. But we all have something to cry for. If we can't cry for the Mikdash, we can cry for the Shoah. If we can't cry for the Shoah, we can cry for the matzav right now in Klal Yisrael, which is horrific. The last 3 weeks have been just the scenes that we see in the streets. If you can't cry from that, then you have to cry for your neighbor. Because there's nobody in this room right now who doesn't have a tremendous peckle that they're carrying. Nobody's not going through a tzara and a tzara. Nobody who doesn't have a health issue, emotional, physical, parnasa, shidduchim, whatever it is. Everybody here has something to cry for. And Tisha B'Av is the day to cry. I just want to end that the Rav just mentioned, Rav Jacobson also mentioned earlier about David HaMelech, mentioned about David HaMelech's love for HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his Gagun for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and I want to show him off. And the Rav just mentioned in the last keynote that we read about the awesomeness and beauty of Eretz Yisrael. A few weeks ago, we lost an individual who was one of the primary defenders and lovers and had all the Gagun that David HaMelech had for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he had for Eretz Yisrael. I had this chus of not necessarily very much of a personal relationship with Rav Shalom Gold, but through the interactions I had, through my beloved Chavrusa, his son, heard his hashkafas, heard his speeches, heard some of his private discussions, and came to appreciate a man who lived his entire life, as everybody knows, was for Eretz Yisrael. But what I want to point out, and I think it's important for us to note, that Yirmi said in his hesped at the Levaya, was that Rebbe Gold loved HaKadosh Baruch Hu and loved every mitzvah, all 613 equally. And the reason that he defended Eretz Yisrael so vehemently was not because this was his mitzvah, like some want to make it out to be. This was not his mitzvah. He followed all 613 very, very closely. But he could never, ever understand how a person could be living in our generation and in a previous generation and live through the horrors of the Shoah and see just 3 years later the gift that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us and see all the nevuos that are written in Tanakh coming alive and coming true. As Rabbi David said also, Rabbi Gold, one of his famous lines was, if you want to speak to Hashem, go to the Kotel. If you want to see Hashem, go to the Shuk Machane Yehuda. Because the peros there are alive. If you can't see all the dreams that we've been dreaming for the last 2,000 years coming alive, then you are completely blind, and most importantly, lacking any effects of Hakaras HaTov. His entire essence, and entire defense of Eretz Yisrael was not because Eretz Yisrael was his mitzvah, it was because he could not understand how even the covenant of HaKadosh Baruch Hu could be blind to it, and not be makir tov for every single thing that he does. If you read his entire memoirs, it's all about Hashem being in the world, and I urge you to do that. And if there's anything that we can work on in the next few weeks, as I said, we all have something to cry for. Things are very challenging right now in the world, in general. But Tisha B'Av leads into the next period in the Jewish calendar. And that period, Elul, is Mesugal to Melech Basada, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was with us. If you keep your eyes closed, you're never going to see that. How do we recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu? How do we make him closer into our lives? Well, we know that our Beinom LaChaveiro and the way that we interact with our fellow brothers and sisters and family members here in this world is a dogma of how we're supposed to have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And maybe if we spend the next 3 weeks of Av appreciating what we have, appreciating our kehila, appreciating our friends, appreciating everything we have this morning, even Shlomo putting together his program, all the work that all the speakers, the Rav put into, Rav Jacobson put into, all the speakers put into it, all the work that Dr. Stern puts into everything, and that Matt puts into everything, and that Eitan and the entire board puts into anything. If we stop fetching for 5 minutes about what we don't have, and take the next 3 weeks to maybe appreciate all that we do and all that everyone does for us on a family level, a communal level, and a klal level, then maybe we can get to the level where we get to Elul and can open our eyes and recognize everything Hashem has given us and work on our relationship with Hashem so that we get to Tishrei, we can truly ask for the things that we want. And we get to Tisha B'Av next year, we won't be sitting anywhere on the floor. We'll be dancing and singing with the gold, with all the 6 million people who were killed, and with the many, many more generations before who just daven to be in the place that we are today.